se le va a venir.
The next case on this morning's calendar is case number 59116, In Re Guardianship as to Moreno. Would counsel please state her appearance and proceed? I note there was no reply brief, so there's no reserve time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Melinda Simpkins, and I am a Deputy Special Public Defender, and we represent the guardian, Christine Moreno, in this action. I know that this court has indicated a list of questions that it would like to have answered. Very briefly, to start, though, I would like to remind the court that guardian unfitness must be established by clear and convincing evidence. The standard of proof under 432B for abuse and neglect is preponderance of the evidence, and in this case, the state proceeded under 159.1905, where the state bears the burden to prove unfitness by clear and convincing evidence. They chose to terminate a guardianship rather than remove the guardian. And suitability of a guardian must be determined based upon the facts at the time of the hearing. And if, I would submit, if this 432B issue was so huge that the state should have moved to set aside the guardianship at the beginning of that 432B case. Over a year later now, Christine Moreno has rehabilitated herself. She's worked her case plan. She's gone over and above what the department was asking her to do. So I would submit that had we had that, that Christine Moreno is not only entitled to that hearing, that she would have very well maintained the guardianship.
Counselor, as you have gone through and you have shortcut a number of things in your analysis in terms of clear and convincing and preponderance, as to that issue, wasn't the party given the opportunity to offer evidence in response to that determination that was made on preponderance?
That's correct, she was, and she chose to enter a plea. However, again, that's a preponderance of the evidence standard. And
once that is then, you have an outcome of that, we are no longer here, and we take that event as a final act and go forward, don't we?
We do, but the whole purpose of 432B is to rehabilitate. And under 432B, it includes guardians, includes parents, and includes persons responsible for the welfare of children.
Ms. Simpkins, I would also ask you to consider in answering this question whether or not the 1 year or any hypothetical time period between where this was before a judge and the time that your client is now rehabilitated, I thought the standard below was best interest of the child. And where does that 1 year of limbo and potential danger and risk fit into what you're telling this court? That if given time and given an evidentiary hearing, perhaps your client would have been able to maintain her guardianship.
Well, Your Honor, my client, with regard to that 1 year, I'm assuming that you're speaking of the Adoption and Safe Families Act and seeking to terminate parental rights at the at 14 of 20 months is I believe under the statute in 432B. It's the policy of the department to seek a termination of parental rights at the end of 1 year. However, my client initially started working her case plan immediately. She was on top of her case plan by the time we got to the 1 year mark. And that's what I'm basing my argument on is, I mean, I wouldn't be standing here if she hadn't worked that case plan, if she hadn't gone to the therapy, if she hadn't done what they'd asked her to do. She's done everything that they'd asked her to do.
Because now, my point is much simpler than that. What happens to the best interest of the child between when this removal or the termination of the guardianship was being considered by the court and the time that your client actually puts herself in a place where the child could be safe with her?
She had done that by the 1 year mark, you know. I'm misunderstanding your question. I'm trying to tell you that she'd done that by the 1 year mark. She was ready to have this child back in place with her.
So then why didn't you get an evidentiary hearing?
I'm sorry?
So why did you do the claim that there needed to be an evidentiary hearing?
I mean, to set aside the guardianship, Your Honor, so that I could show the court in the 159 proceeding, because they didn't have this information before then, it was in the 432B proceeding, that she had rehabilitated herself in the 432B proceeding by the end of that year and had done what they'd been asking her to do. So that's why I'm saying that she needed that evidentiary hearing so that she could put that before the court, so the court could make an informed decision as to what was in the best interest of the child.
Counsel, even without that evidentiary hearing, wasn't she required as to putting forth additional information, and she chose not to?
Your Honor, I apologize. I was on model court business. I had another attorney here for me that day, and it's my recollection that we had requested the evidentiary hearing.
This is not the evidentiary hearing. I thought the court asked if they wished to submit any additional information as to that, and they chose not to.
Well, that's not my recollection, Your Honor. My recollection is the attorney requested the evidentiary hearing.
Check the record.
With regard to the appointment of the guardian ad litem, I'm getting into the court's questions that the woman has to address. I would submit that a GAL was not appointed in this instance because the guardianship was summarily granted without an evidentiary hearing. The second question was if the guardian was not an attorney, who would represent the attorney in court? Anthony has an attorney to represent his desires. Ms. Barr is here today. The guardian ad litem would have, from what I understand their duties are, would have made a recommendation as to the best interest of the court after an investigation. Can the guardian ad litem be appointed while a guardian is already in place? Guardian ad litem is for the litigation. It's my understanding that a regular guardian is either the person in the estate. If a conflict of interest arises, I believe it would be proper to have both a guardian and a guardian ad litem. And this court kind of addressed this in the case of Byrne versus Walker. That was at 74 Nevada 230. It's a 1958 case, but in that case, the allegation was the guardian was stealing from the ward, and the grandmother of the ward sued as the next friend. So that there is precedent for both a guardian ad litem and a guardian being appointed in case. Now, with regard to questions 4, 5, 6, and 7 relating to party status of the DA's office in the Department of Family Services, I would submit that neither one is the real party in interest. I believe that the 432B court, it would be the real party in interest as the entity having lordship over this child. A real party in interest possesses a right to enforce the claim and has a significant interest in the litigation. And here, as far as the DA is concerned, the DA is an attorney who's got to represent the public interest and cannot proceed on their own unless they're sued or suing in their individual capacity. Under 432B550, state and the DA are not persons who can have custody of a child, so the interest, I believe, there is too attenuated. As far as the Department of Family Services is concerned, DFS only has custody arising from the 432B action. Now, 432B060 defines a custodian as a person having legal custody, but it's not the type of legal custody that we talk about in like a regular divorce case. DFS can't get surgical treatment for a child without court's permission. They can't give the child psychotropic medications. They can't give the child, they can't even make really a best interest determination independently from the court. It's the court who makes these determinations. Further, under 432B550, the Department of Family Services is only granted temporary custody, which I submit to you can be changed any time for any reason based on the court's determination of best interest. Now, I would submit that this type of custody is too temporary to establish a right to enforce claim. The significant interest in any litigation, I believe, would belong to the court. The district court makes the determination of best interest, and I believe hearing ministers, Department of Family Services, DAs, CASA, Children's Attorney Project, Special Public Defender, we only can make recommendations to the court. These recommendations are not binding. As this court discussed in a recent matter, in a recent case of in the matter of AB, which is 128 Nevada Advance Opinion 70, the district court can't abdicate that responsibility to third parties. And I think the better course of action here, because the mother has had her parental rights terminated in Arizona, and now they're looking at termination of parental rights as far as she's concerned here, is for the 432B court to take jurisdiction of both the guardianship and the termination of parental rights. And that way, the court would have all the evidence before it to make the determination without possibly competing court orders. The standard would be clear and convincing, and Maryland's due process rights would be ignored. The court, again, would not abdicate its responsibility to see to the child's best interest. It would have everything before it. With regard to whether the DA's office would gain from the intervention, I would have to defer to Mr. Cordes on that issue. I submit that the need for protection of minors lasts only as long as the protection is necessary, and once the rehabilitation is complete, the need for protection ends. And right now, I mean, if you had asked me that question 6 months ago, I would have told you that the DA's office was, what they would gain would be punishment of Christina Moreno. But right now, because we have instituted, or the DA's office has instituted an agency representation model, things are kind of in a state of flux in Las Vegas. So I would submit if they wanted to gain permanency for the child, the guardianship with Christina Moreno can do that more quickly than termination of parental rights and adoption, because Christina's case plan is complete. It was complete back then. It's complete now. When was guardianship deemed final? Guardianships of children with unfit parents are final until the parent rehabilitates, and then the parent starts the action to set aside the guardianship. Preferences apply. The court makes a determination of best interest. But I think we can all agree that children need stability. We don't want to bounce children around. They need to be in one place. So it would seem that the guardianship would be final on the granting of it, except in the limited circumstances of when the parent comes in to set aside. And if there is a problem, such as this case that arose with the guardian, and the parent can't take the child, then I think TPR and guardianship termination in the same TPR court is the proper way to go. Can the DA's office represent the interest of a child if it must represent the public interest? The interest of the child, the best interest of the child, I submit, is the sole determination of the district court. Again, the DA's office, just like everyone else that appears in 432B court, only makes recommendations. Whether 16 months was too short a period for reunification attempts, and as I discussed previously, Grandma has worked her case plan. She's gone over and above everything she was asked to do, and she did that within the time limits under the 432B case. So if DFS had continuing concerns, the court had continuing concerns, her case plan was never amended to address those concerns. She wasn't offered any further services to address those concerns. I can only conclude that there was never any intent to reunify Christina Moreno with her grandson. The reasons the department intervened or DA intervened in this case and not others, I think that back then when I filed this appeal, this had to do with the prosecutorial model that the DA's office was following. That has since changed, which leads me to the next question. Is the Clark County DA attempting to switch to the Washoe County model for representation? I believe so. The DA has switched to the agency representation a little over a month ago, and there's a shift in policy that's taking place at this time. Now, that's not to say everything's going smoothly. I mean, there are problems that are arising. I believe there's a meeting on Friday to discuss some of those problems with the judges. But, for example, previously, defense attorneys or parents' attorneys could talk to the Department of Family Services caseworkers and try to reach agreements regarding issues such as increasing visitation and things of that nature. Now we're prohibited from doing that. We can only discuss facts. We have to litigate these issues now. When the DA disagrees with their client, we find that the caseworker's coming to us and asking us to argue in a certain manner. So that's an issue that's been coming up. DAs are refusing, and I'm not saying Mr. Cordes or anyone here today, but we've run into DAs refusing to allow child and family team meetings to happen. When the hearing masters are telling us, don't bring this issue to me, go have a child and family team meeting. So we have reached out to the DA's office. The DA's office has reached out to us. We are going to be raising these concerns. Hopefully in the near future, the adversarial atmosphere and the prosecutorial model is going to change substantially, and I think that this is the first step in the right direction. So we are in the process of adjustment, and it's going to be rocky for a while, but I think I'm optimistic. So, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Good morning, Justice. My name is Ron Cordes with Clark County District Attorney's Office. I'll be presenting the case for the respondent. However, Ms. Barr from the Children's Attorneys Project would wanted to speak for about 3 minutes, so I would like to give her the 3 minutes right now and then reserve the time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court.
Honorable Chief Justice, and Honorable Justices. I'm here to talk about the most important person in this case, and that is my client, Anthony Marino. Anthony is presently in Arizona with his maternal aunt and his siblings. He's doing extremely well. He is visiting his siblings, and he's very happy there. Anthony is now 14. He will be 15 on April 20th. So I think that he should have a say in these proceedings. Anthony would like closure in his life. He wants to remain in Arizona. He was sexually abused by his grandmother's husband. The guardianship with the grandmother is preventing him from having some finality in his life. This way, if it's the guardianship is terminated, we can either do a guardianship or the grandma can, the aunt can adopt in Arizona. This has been going on for this child for 3 years. And I know as we get older that time goes much faster than it did when we were younger. I know when you're 4 years old, you're excited to be 4 and a half and then 4 and 3 quarters. Or it's not unlike a justice who indicated that the time between Thanksgiving and Christmas as a child is forever. And we know as adults it goes very quickly. This child has been in care for 4 years. It is time for him to have some permanency. He needs to be safe and secure, and the only way to do that is to terminate this guardianship and allow things to go forward under the ICPC in Arizona. The legal issue for this case in terminating the guardianship was whether there was clear and convincing evidence. And I think there was clear and convincing evidence. The child had been out of the home since June 11th of 2009. The grandmother pled no contest to an amended petition. And that is part of the appendix AA, page 8. The petition, and if you just read it, is sufficient to be clear and convincing evidence. The grandmother pled to neglecting the child and abusing the child by keeping him in front of, allowing him to be sexually abused, and then taking the child to the jail weekly to visit her husband. She also indicated that she was unwilling and unable to protect Anthony from sexual abuse, and that she does not believe that the sex abuse occurred. Second, the guardian had no care or control over the ward when the motion was brought to terminate the guardianship. Another proceeding, the juvenile court proceeding, conclusively established that the guardian engaged in abuse and neglect. Shouldn't that be enough? Isn't there a judicial economy to be made for allowing one court to make a determination? It does not promote judicial efficiency and causes unnecessary trauma to victims, especially those of sexual abuse. It also would be duplicative in civil actions to decide placement of a child in two different courts. It doesn't make any sense to do this in two different ways. It makes sense to be able to terminate the guardianship and to be able to use just the admission of the grandma as her being unsuitable. I do think that the court acted appropriately, and I think that this decision of the district court regarding the termination should be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cordes, as you're approaching, I would like you to begin to consider addressing whether or not we should, this court or another court by rule perhaps, should be having 159 evidentiary hearings as a matter of course.
Yes, Justice. To respond to your question, and good afternoon, Justices. I apologize for kind of the way that this transpired, but Ron Cordes with the District Attorney's Office. To address the question, I do not believe an evidentiary hearing is necessary in all guardianship 159 proceedings to address whether or not a guardian is suitable to continue in that role. I believe that the evidence that is submitted by way of motion, affidavits, by way of the opposition that was granted to Ms. Marino in this case, could have provided the court with sufficient evidence to proceed in making a determination that it was clearly and convincingly established she was unsuitable. So at this point, I do not believe that the statutory provisions in 159 require an evidentiary hearing, and have submitted case law in support of that position by way of the brief that was submitted. To address Justice Douglas, your question to Ms. Simpkins earlier, the evidence, as I indicated, was clear and convincing at 1 year that Ms. Moreno was unsuitable. There had been routine periodic review hearings before the juvenile court relative to the possible return of Anthony to her care. During each of those review hearings, the juvenile court determined, after hearing from Ms. Moreno, her attorney, from the state, and at that time, the Department of Family Services, by way of their report, that Anthony could not safely be returned to the care of Ms. Moreno, thereby negating the necessity for a continued guardianship on her behalf. As indicated, Anthony... Yes, Justice.
It doesn't appear, though, that the court applied a clear and convincing standard.
The guardianship court, when it issued the determination?
Right.
From the findings issued by the commissioner at the time, Commissioner Dottinger, there was no specific reference to clear and convincing. Yes, Your Honor, I would agree.
How does this court, an appellate court, which does not make factual determinations, overcome or resolve a dispute like this, where it appears as though, if you accept counsel's argument, there's clear error in either failing to state or failing to apply a clear and convincing evidence standard in a case in which there is no evidentiary hearing? We may agree, had we been the trial judge, that the presentments made to the district court constituted clear and convincing evidence, but we don't make those determinations here. We're asked to determine whether there was error, and there appears to have been error. How do we overcome that?
Well, recently the Supreme Court issued their decision referenced by Ms. Simpkins in the matter of AB, referencing a commissioner's recommendation and the district court's approval or disapproval of the recommendation based upon the record before the court. In that case, there was an indication that the district court did not apply a statutory provision of clearly erroneous, and this court still found that the district court's determination was appropriate in light of the evidence that was submitted to the district court judge by way of an objection and opposition, very similar to this case, and found that the district court ruling was appropriate given the determination. That ruling, if I can recall, does not specifically say that the state failed to meet certain conditions in the juvenile court proceedings did not contain a specific reference to the burden of proof. I think it's very similar to this case, where the hearing master found that the evidence that was submitted by way of the pleadings was sufficient to make that determination. I think the case law in the state of Nevada supports a finding by the district court that the appropriate evidence was presented by way of the pleadings to terminate the guardianship and find this guardian unsuitable based upon the other proceedings in the juvenile matter.
Could be, but it seems like that decision may have started us on a slippery slope of having this court make de novo factual determinations where the wrong evidentiary burden has been applied.
Again, Justice Hardesty, I do not believe that an inappropriate standard was applied by the guardianship commissioner nor approved by the district court judge who ultimately signed off on this decision once the objection was heard. Again, the pleadings that were filed in the guardianship case under the 159 matter contained an opposition and a motion. It also then had an objection as well as legal argument as to the standard and more pleadings by way of the submission by the state in opposition to the objection. So there was all the documentary evidence available relative to Ms. Moreno and her suitability to serve as a guardian was submitted to the district court.
So you're saying that this court should infer that the district court judge, even though they didn't state clear and convincing, applied clear and convincing?
I believe it is appropriate to infer that based upon all of the documentary evidence that was submitted to that court during the course of the underlying proceedings.
Thank you.
To address the questions raised by the subsequent order issued in November of 2011, by way of the very first question, a guardian ad litem. In the underlying guardianship case, a guardian ad litem was not appointed. That matter began in 2003, approximately 6 years prior to the Department of Family Services or the district attorney's office becoming aware of Anthony Moreno. During the course of those proceedings, Ms. Moreno was appointed as the guardian and continued to serve in that role for a period of approximately 6 years before Anthony came to the attention of the Department of Family Services. Once Anthony became a ward of the court, or in the juvenile court process, a guardian ad litem was not appointed. And to address the specifics, it's a lack of resources within Clark County relative to the role of a guardian ad litem. We did seek to have an attorney appointed to represent Anthony and thereby present his voice by way of Ms. Barr. There was also a CASA appointed. Now, they did not specifically term a guardian ad litem, but there was a CASA appointed also for Anthony. So there were two individuals who were representing one his interest and one a best interest standard by way of the CASA and an individual who was reporting to the court independently from the Department of Family Services or the District Attorney's Office. To address the intervention issue, when the state was informed that permanency could not be achieved for Anthony, the only legitimate avenue that could be pursued legally was to seek to set aside the guardianship. Because the guardianship was formed in 2003, prior to any involvement by the department or the district attorney's office, obviously the assertion by way of intervention could not be done in that guardianship proceedings prior to the determination of the guardianship. But looking at the statutory authority presented by way of the rules of civil procedure, the only avenue was to seek a motion to intervene in the guardianship case to assert that Anthony no longer benefited from that guardianship and that the guardian was unsuitable. Procedure appeared to be appropriate, and it was filed with an opposition given to Ms. Simpkins or time for her to respond to that. I think the court considered all that and granted the motion to intervene, finding that it was in Anthony's best interest to assert different information that was coming out of the juvenile court process. I respectfully disagree wholeheartedly with Ms. Simpkins' presentation that Ms. Moreno today is appropriate. She's still legally married to the individual that sexually abused Anthony, and the juvenile court continues to hear periodic reviews on this case and is still determined that it is not appropriate to return Anthony to Ms. Moreno because she does not provide a safe environment for Anthony. Anthony's currently in Arizona, as you heard, by way of his attorney, and by all accounts is succeeding. That information is being presented to the juvenile court at this time and has resulted in Anthony having a determination that absent this matter pending before your honors, that permanency can be achieved for him in the state of Arizona with his relative who is providing the care for him. As it relates to the representation model, you've heard statements from both attorneys relative to the district attorney's involvement. As you're aware, District Attorney Steve Wilson from my office has determined that we are executing the agency representation model that has gone into effect. I'm not sure exactly what the Washoe County model is. I know that we've adopted the ABA standards for agency representation model, and so that is implemented. As you can tell by some of the paperwork that is submitted in this case, there have been determinations that the DA's office represented the public, and also there were some documents filed with representation of the agency. It was never clear exactly what the model was, and with the statutory provision in 432B510 that says that the district attorney's office shall represent the public interest, that was asserted. We've now come to a conclusion through additional research and review of literature relative to the matter that that can be achieved by representing the Department of Family Services as a part of the county. The county is always the public interest advocate for children, and a safe environment is what we are trying to achieve for this child. I believe that the district attorney's office could have been considered a real party in interest, representing the public's interest in a safe environment for Anthony. And so I hope I have answered your questions. At this point, I will entertain any additional questions if you have.
Where in 159.18531 does the DA acquire standing to pursue this issue? I appreciate the information about the change in policy that this case predates that?
We believe, Your Honor, and we previously asserted that pursuant to 432B510, the determination is statutorily prescribed that the district attorney's office would represent the public interest. During the course of the underlying guardianship proceedings, the child had been placed into the temporary custody of the Department of Family Services, so the determination was made to assert their position, the Department of Family Services, through our office, seeking to intervene and inform the guardianship court of the problems that the guardian presented.
So, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I apologize.
No, go ahead.
So I believe that by asserting the Department of Family Services temporary custodial status that was granted by the juvenile court, we complied with the statutory provision in 159 that you're referencing.
So are you now saying that it's unnecessary for us to reach the issue of the DA intervening on behalf of the public interest because you have a client?
I believe it is not necessary for this court to make a determination relative to that matter.
So in this case, you were acting for your client, not for the DA's office.
You'll see that there were proceedings that were initiated by myself that indicated that we were representing the Department of Family Services. I had a deputy district attorney who then subsequently filed very similar paperwork in the same proceeding because of the procedural posture, represented that the attorney was for the public. Again, it was a very confusing time given the statutory reference, and so I think as it stands today, that decision is not necessary by this court. Any additional questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
This case will stand submitted and will be in recess.